petition a court, that is the sentencing court, and present to the sentencing court whatever full compliance there was or had been, and the sentencing courts would have the discretion in an adversarial hearing, which is fair because that would represent both the victim and the defendant, to determine whether or not that amount of post-prison supervision or whatever the level of supervision was should be changed or terminated. But within the statute itself, no. But there is already some mechanisms in place as to how the judiciary would work in that type of a hearing.
It seems to me that for at least some people, lifetime or supervision for 30 years or 20 years is going to be a waste of money after a while. Why just keep throwing that money down the drain supervising somebody who doesn't need it?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, if in response to that comment and question, I would assume that there would still be administrative rules in place and hopefully that some discretion as far as levels of supervision to come into compliance with what the court orders were. And certainly there are already provided for statutory procedures and administrative procedures and judicial procedures for review of any sentence where someone is under that type of probation supervision or parole board
supervision. It is part of the original the sentence, so it's not anything that you can adjust along the way.
Without
it is
overview.
Not something you can
it's
adjust.
Not something you can adjust along the way.
I wonder if we shouldn't provide a vehicle for that. So that
well, in the sentencing scheme, one would have to look at that. Senator Hill.
Yes, I was looking at the fiscal impact. are the resources, is this included in the governor's budget? I mean, are the resources available to do this?
We have a lease classroom coming up.
Oh, okay, because I guess the point is that we pass bills just like what we used to do with prison sentences, and then we don't have any space, and then we feel good that we feel we've passed the laws, and I mean, I guess I just want to be sure that we're accomplishing something.
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, frankly, I understand that there has been a rather severe fiscal impact that has been attached to this bill. And my only statement can be, if that is true in its worst scenario, it's worth paying for dollar, because of the times we have looked at the newspaper and seen the recidivist impact of sexual offenders on the victims. And so if that is true, then it needs to be prioritized. And Mr. Shepard, Mr. Spencer actually has a better response to that.
My only comment on that, Madam Chair, Senator Hill, would be, my understanding is that the fiscal impact is predicated upon the worst possible scenario. Our findings, and Chief Deputy Robson will bear this out through community corrections, are that a number of the category of criminal we're dealing with here, the pedophile and so forth, are quite capable of paying their own supervision and their own treatment costs. And we would, I think we're planning to try to come up with some evidence that will show you that the fiscal impact will be somewhat less than, significantly less than what you're looking at on the fiscal impact statement before you.
Let me ask a
Madam Chair. Yes.
Right now you're limited to 3 years. Do you have enough people now to do that? Are there enough supervisory resources out there to take care of that now, quite honestly?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, for my limited knowledge of corrections, I guess I'd have to say I don't know, except for the fact that you have to establish different supervisory criteria for different types of offenders. And that's something that corrections is going to have to answer.
And Madam Chair, and I'll let it go. My only point is that, you know, we did this with sentencing before. I mean, we came in and my first session and enhanced the penalties for everything. And the thing is, nobody was serving anything there because we didn't have enough prison space. And I understand what you're saying about the resources, but I just want to be sure that we're not just raising expectations or sending out a message that we're going to take care of all this because this is needed. But I'm just saying there's a resource side of it, and Measure 5 and the whole
sure.
bit. So.
Madam Chair and Senator Hill, that is something that we bore heavily in mind in crafting this legislation. As I said, our expectation is that a great number of these people will be able to bear the cost of that supervision. We feel that our first obligation is to protect those that cannot protect themselves, and that, of course, children are going to come high on that list first. And that's the direction that we're going with this. That's our motivation.
Let us just excuse you and hear from Elise and talk about the numbers. Thank you. I would say, I reassure you that this committee has already been down to the Ways and Means Committee to ask for add-backs for community corrections and for targeted high-risk populations as a first priority to opening for their prison beds right at the moment. So we're doing our part to get these people's community safety to take a look at. Elise.
For the record, Madam Chair, I'm Elise Clausen, Assistant Director of the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections supports the need to expand the supervision time of sex offenders. This particular bill has a long-term fiscal impact on the department. It actually is different than Senate Bill 452 because it does not have immediate impact, nor does it specify the kinds of supervision or the program issues. Long-term impact would actually, in terms of supervision, would start the fourth year after this bill is passed, because currently they would be on for 3 years anyway. On for the maximum sentence on for probation is 3 years, or for post-prison supervision. So the impact is 4 years out. It will have, at that point, I think in that year, in that biennium, the impact is about $230,000, as I recall. There's also the potential, I think, and we don't know exactly what that is, of a bed impact long-term, because you are keeping people on a longer supervision time, and so you're increasing the length of time that person is at risk, at least in supervision, and at risk of a revocation. And so there's a fairly substantial chance that they will come back on revocations, and so there's a bed impact there. What exactly that impact would be, I'm not sure. I think the other thing, the bill talks about the fact that supervision fees would pay for the additional supervision. While we are fairly successful at collecting supervision fees from many of these offenders, certainly not all of them, and the amount that we currently collect would not pay for all the costs of this kind of supervision. So I think it's, while they may be able to contribute, they certainly would not pay for all of those costs. Today, supervision fees that are paid by offenders do go in to support supervision, and they pay for a portion of our S&S costs. It's just a part of our budget. I mean, we collect right now about $2.5 million from all of our offenders, from 37,000 offenders. So it's not a huge amount that you collect from all of the offenders, and it then goes into our basic budget to help support community supervision. We do, however, support the extended supervision time for certain sex offenders. We agree with many of the treatment professionals that supervision along with treatment does improve their risk to the community, and they do, many of them do succeed on supervision, or at least while they're on supervision. We would just caution the sort of the long-term fiscal impact and at least have us look at that.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay.
Are there questions of Elise?
Yes, Hale. Yes, Madam Chair. Do you have the resources that you need now to do this kind of supervision on the current law?
Madam Chairman, Senator Hill, this bill, as I understand it, does not outline what the level of supervision would be. It merely extends the supervision. So it's debatable as to whether or not we do. We have whatever supervision resources we have now, and these offenders would go in and be supervised wherever they classify out, which is usually in medium or high categories. Not necessarily intensive supervision, but at least at a minimum in a medium level. So they would receive active supervision, and I believe there are resources to continue to supervise those sex offenders that are in the system today. The impact's going to be because they will stay on supervision so much longer. So much like ballot measure 10 folks, it'll keep building up, and we'll keep having more and more on the supervision rolls. So that's where the real impact becomes, is 4 years out.
I'm just asking, how intensely then are you supervising these people now?
Madam Chairman, Senator Hill, it varies. Some of them are in intensive supervision. Some of them are receiving fairly minimal supervision. Depends on the offender and how they classify in the risk, and that coupled with the resources we have. So it varies. But all of our sex offenders, pretty much with few exceptions, are currently receiving some active supervision, which could be anything from once a month to a maximum of maybe four times a month being seen.
Is it adequate? I mean, do you feel that what you're doing now Do you have the resources to do the job right? That's what I'm asking.
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, no, I don't think it's necessarily adequate.
How often, generally, do you have polygraphs on the bulk of this population?
Madam Chair, that really varies depending on whether or not they're in a treatment program.
Okay, let me ask a different question. How many, what's the general ratio on intensive supervision? I'm assuming that the only way they're going to get polygraphs on a regular basis is if they are on some intensive supervision.
Either if they're in intensive supervision or if they're in a treatment program that requires polygraphs, which in which case they could be on a lower level of supervision, but the treatment program that they're involved in may require polygraphs as a part of that treatment program. So the caseload on intensive supervision averages about 1 to 30, 1 to 35. Our preference is for it to be about 1 to 25. Those people receive polygraph exams as they go through treatment anywhere from as much as once a month to ending up being couple of three times a year. Some of the treatment programs require it, you know, at varying sorts of times.
I'm sure. And then I'll just be done. I just don't want us to just be fooling, and I appreciate your answers, Elise, and I know the people that you have are overworked. I mean, I know that from talking to them. Mm-hmm. And I just don't want us to fool ourselves. I think we're doing some real great thing here by just changing the law. We're not willing to put some resources behind it. So if we're going to do this, let's hopefully we'll have enough revenue to do it. But we have to be honest with ourselves about the resources that we have. We allowed ourselves with prisons to just go to sleep for years and then suddenly realize that we did not have enough prison space. And I want to make sure we don't do the same thing for this. So I hope that you'll really let us know really honestly about what the resource needs are in trying to accomplish these kind of things. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks. Further questions? Thank you, Elise.
Appreciate that.
Stan?
Chair Cohen, committee members, I'll be brief. I'm Stan Robson from Benton County Sheriff's Department. Answer to a couple of questions. In my experience with sex offenders, the question earlier by Senator Shoemaker about the long term, 20, 30 years, I've dealt with individuals who are offending still in their 70s and 80s, and it isn't something that's going to quit just because it goes beyond a particular age group. So I think it's very important that we can extend this as long as we can. I know there's going to be some physical impact, but I think that in comparing it to prison time, it's going to be much less significant, and it does work better than prison incarceration in that there are controls set up that can more effectively deal with these people in the community. They can be working. They can pay for part of their way, and it's going to be a lot less expense to the community and to the citizens in Oregon. I think that it's much more effective. We do know that they are under control during this supervision, that they are fairly easy to monitor and control. And when they do have these various stipulations, such as the polygraph, they do not recommit at that particular time. It is an unknown when we get on to the 7, 8, 9, 10 years whether or not they're going to maintain that control, but I certainly think it's worth the risk.
Madam Chair? Are you saying that none of these people ever get over it?
In my experience, I've not seen anyone that I felt could. It's
Does
a lifestyle, it's a sexuality that they've developed, it's a learned behavior, it's their life preference.
Does sending them to prison do any good?
No.
Why do we send them to prison?
Because we have no other resource at this time.
Supervision.
Supervision, I think, is more effective than prison.
Maybe we have a trade-off we should be talking about.
Maybe.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Let's get 2544 quickly. Russ and Detective Gustafson, Jim McIntyre.
You get us all up at once, huh?
Well, I think it's... takes less if you shuttle back. It takes less shuttling time.
Madam Chair, Russ Spencer for the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Again, once I will sit here and field them, and Jim will hit them. So I defer to Deputy District
Madam Chair, members of the committee, shuttling.
Right.
The House Bill 2544 is intended to, the caption is very misleading. It allows prosecution of females for crime of rape. What this statute is intended to do is make the crime of rape a gender-neutral offense. It incorporates a full revision of the rape and the rape statutes. And really what it's meant is to bring into parity the criminal offenses of females who engage in sexual intercourse with males. Generally speaking, in dealing with basic statistics, the vast majority of the time, we're speaking of females who engage in sexual intercourse with minors who are less than the statutory age limits. Currently, if a female engages in sexual intercourse with a male who is less than the statutory age limits as set forth, they commit the crime of sexual abuse in the first degree, where a male engaged in the same conduct with a female less than those statutory age limits engages in the elevated felony offenses of rape 1, rape 2, and rape 3. Additionally, this crime would create the crime of rape in the first degree for a female engaging in forcible sexual intercourse with a male. But we have had, at least in Multnomah County, and I can't speak for other counties, we have had multiple instances of some very severe, very aggravated child sexual abuse cases where mothers have used their young male children who have been less than 12 years of age, less than 14 years of age, in sexual play and, in fact, what could best be described as orgiastic behavior with their boyfriends and husbands, where the boyfriends and husbands could be charged with a variety of Class A and Class B felonies, but the mother could only be charged with a Class C felony of sexual abuse in the first degree. That's one of the reasons that this statute sort of came to the forefront. I should say that I was Jim McIntyre speaking on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, but I also spoke with Kate Brown, who's the from the Women's Rights Coalition. And since she could not be here this evening, we agreed that I could state her position. Their position is that they are not opposed to this bill, that they, however, would urge the committee and the legislature in the long term to consider a complete revision of the sexual offenses relative to eliminating gender distinctions between the sexual offenses. But I also, as I indicated, I spoke with Kate Brown. I told her we would talk about that tonight, so I would represent her position also this evening.
And for the record, we do have her written testimony.
Okay.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Okay.
I'm Christy Gustafson. I'm a detective with Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. It's difficult to sometimes get the victims and or their families to come in and testify before you, so I'm going to speak on behalf of a 7-year-old. Not too long ago, a nearby law enforcement agency notified me about a young children that were left in the home of their biological mother and her boyfriend. Another child, the 7-year-old boy that I was talking about, was in a treatment facility and had disclosed sexual abuse involving his mother. An experienced detective who observed the therapist's interview with the 7-year-old described the child's behavior as one of the most astounding in his experience. The child's actions resembled those of an animal. The boy was given an anatomical doll and, quote, immediately undressed the doll. He kicked, hit, and threw the mother doll for a couple of minutes, then spread the doll's legs and put his tongue in the vaginal area. He then sucked on the doll's breast and was reluctant to put the doll down. During the remainder of the session, he attempted to continue sucking on the mother doll's breast, and when the doll was pulled from him, it was wet with saliva. He stated he always slept with his mother. He reported that his mother would suck on his penis and also stated he would lay on top of her and put his penis into her vagina. He demonstrated this activity using the dolls. That's the end of the quote. The therapist learned from other staff members that when the 7-year-old prepared for bed, he would simulate sexual intercourse with stuffed animals and explained he'd learned this behavior from his mother, who warned him not to tell anyone. When I took the 7-year-old's siblings into protective custody, his two younger brothers were playing outside without any pants on. Later, they were given stuffed animals as a toy. At the shelter home, they tore open the crotches of the stuffed animals so they could insert their fingers into the openings. I found this to be an extreme case, yet under the current law, without this bill, the abuse by the mother to the 7-year-old was a sex abuse one, which was a C felony, rather than an A misdemeanor, or an A felony.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much. Ken Robson and Judge Thornton.
Chair Cohen and committee members, I'm Stan Robson from Benton County Sheriff's Department. I'm not going to belabor this any further, just to reiterate what was already stated, that we work many cases where adult females and the relationship with young males is very devastating. And unfortunately, our society talks about protecting our daughters where when it's an adult female who's having relationships with a young juvenile male, it's just sex education. Where I've seen boys at 13, 14, 15 years of age, when they're not sophisticated enough to deal with that kind of relationship, are actually extremely emotionally devastated with this and have extreme problems as they grow up and later in life. And I would just encourage this consideration for this particular bill.
Right, thank you. Judge Thornton.
Yes, Robert Thornton. Senior Judge, Court of Appeals, and also I'm currently a volunteer researcher for the Crime Analysis Center. And I ask for time, Madam Chair and members of the committee, to update on a research project that I did and submitted a memo to the committee at the start of the session. So this is of general application, and I believe it is current and of value to the committee. First of all, I examined the Vermont sex offender program. Some of you may have seen it on national television. It was widely heralded as a new development, a new advancement in the field. The Dr. Pethers, who is in charge of the program in Vermont, is reported to be the first person in the country that has applied to sex offender treatment the relapse prevention methods that are used in the treatment of drug offenders and drug abusers. And in his particular project there in Vermont, he did show the following on recidivism of convicted sex offenders who participated in his relapse prevention program. Out of rapists, offenders in outpatient therapy between 2 and 4.5 years. You see, we're talking about a very costly program, but this is what he showed, a relapse of only 2, in other words, a 10% relapse rate for rapists. On pedophiles, out of 104, he showed a relapse of only 3, which is a 3% relapse rate, and in a total, overall, a 4% relapse rate, which is substantially less than any of the programs reported. In the paper that I prepared and submitted to the committee, you possibly recall that I talked in terms about studies on recidivism worldwide. And to my great surprise, the outstanding survey of recidivism studies all over the world was done by 3 researchers in Eugene. And they made a study of 42 programs all over the world, what they considered top quality recidivism programs. And they found that not one of these 42 programs provided a scientific evaluation, an outcome evaluation. They said all of them. And these are programs from all over the world. Incidentally, it included in 5 Scandinavian countries where they permit surgical castration in certain types of cases. But his study was perhaps the lowest of all that I examined, and I have that paper. I also examined the study in California at the Atascadero hospital there where they are on a five-year in-depth study of relapse of sex offender treatment programs. And I think that we can look forward to receiving valuable information as they complete their program. And also, program which I was perhaps most impressed with of all is the Washington State program. They have no problems with Measure 5. They have lots of money, and they have done a very thorough job. And I would say this, that if this committee ultimately goes into some type of an interim committee, I would say it'd be well worth the money to send one of your staff people up there for a whole week, because what they do is truly outstanding, and their research program is particularly good. They have created what they call the Washington State Institute for Public Policy, and they have a long-term research project that covers all aspects of criminal enforcement, law enforcement, criminal justice, and sex offenders. In September of last year, as part of this ongoing program, of course, you know the Washington legislature put their sex offender law changes all into one big law. It's called the Washington Community Protection Act of 1990. They put all the things that we put in separate bills, they put it all in one bill. And in September of last year, they conducted a seminar entitled Successful Interventions with Sex Offenders, Learning What Works. And of course, that's the test of all this. Does this work? That's what we want to know. And perhaps the greatest shortcoming of our own programs, and I looked at the programs at the State Hospital and OSP and OSCI, Fairview, McLaren, Hillcrest, the greatest shortcoming is we do not have a valid outcome evaluation program in place on these programs. We don't know whether they work or they don't. We have opinions, but we do not have, just as this study that I mentioned from Eugene showed, they do have programs that they think work, but we don't know for sure that they do. So that if we do put money into programs of this type, we should require, as does the federal government, that we have a valid scientific outcome evaluation program in place. The Senator Hill was speaking about the cost aspects of this and Measure 5. One of the things that rather impressed me was right here in the state of Oregon in Jackson County. In Jackson County, they have what I think is one of the best volunteer citizen parole and probation officer programs anywhere. Been going on for 16 years, and those sex offenders in Jackson County are now paying 80% of their own treatment costs. Marion County is now looking toward volunteer parole and probation officers. And this is something that we've got to think about now that we've got Measure 5 to deal with. But here, they're now considering. And then, of course, in Japan, the bulk of probation and parole supervision is done by volunteers, about 46,000 of them in the country. And it's very effective, and they have a much lower recidivism rate on those offenders than they do at the national level. Now, the last thing I want to talk about, and then I'll quit, is the prevention-oriented strategies. I'm not prepared to say that our treatment programs here should be eliminated wholesale at all, but we do have to face the fact that there's going to be limited dollars to go around. And so what I'm saying is that we should look at programs like the Utah Parent-Child Safety Program. Utah has a prevention education program that I think is outstanding. It's a four-phase program. It starts with the parent-teacher orientation in the school system. They involve the parents right from the start. They then go to the McGruff Science Program, which are the Safe Homes Project. Then follows classroom instruction. That's the third phase. And the fourth phase is maintenance of the program. There are programs of this type going on in Oregon, but they're uncertain, and they're not overall coordinated. in Washington, where the state pays 75% of the cost of education, the child safety education in the schools is all directed from the state superintendent of public instruction office. That's in charge of a Dr. Ruth Harms, her title, Supervisor, Child Abuse Prevention Education. So I'm saying then that if we go into this program, I believe that we should give serious thought to child safety education at the state level and be under the supervision of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, because I believe you're going to get a bigger bang for your buck out of child safety education than you will perhaps out of clinical treatment, just based on the lack of proof and support for that thing. In Japan, for instance, how do they meet this problem? Students assemble in their neighborhoods on their way to school, and they come to school in a group under the supervision of a senior student, an older student, and a ditto going back. They have lots of latchkey kids in Japan, too. But this is bringing the children themselves into the act to teach them to look out for each other. These are things that I think we're going to have to look at more and more with Measure 5. And that's all I'm going to say, and thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you very much for coming. It's always good to see you, Judge.
If a person knowingly gives that false information, it makes that offense a Class B misdemeanor, which means that a police officer could, in that case, then arrest. There are times, and I see that this was presented by Lake Oswego at the request of Lake Oswego Police Department, particularly in communities, city police, where you're dealing with the same people continually, and they are giving you false information. And it just puts a stop to that.
Okay. Any questions about that? Thank you. Next.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Larry Kraft, Fish and Wildlife Division, Oregon State Police. House Bill 2139 would establish a Class A misdemeanor. The offense of giving a false information to an officer, the person knowingly uses or gives a false name, address, or date of birth to any police officer for the purpose of the officers issuing a citation under the authority of ORS 153705 to 153765. Currently, the crime of providing false information to an officer only applies to criminal and traffic-related offenses. Passage of this measure would extend this provision to wildlife, commercial fishery laws, and violations of Oregon State Marine Board law. Oregon State Police is in support of this measure.
Questions?
Chair, I had a question regarding 2384 at all.
Okay.
I went by so fast. On traffic infractions, the police officer's got a, he can plug right into the central computer, can't he, from his vehicle normally?
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, yes.
And on that central computer, don't they maintain fairly current liability insurance information?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, they contain no information regarding liability insurance. It is voluntarily or put on by the owner of the car on the back of the registration. And there's, I believe DMV checks about 1% by statute. They're required to check every biennium to see if people are, what percentage of people actually have the insurance they're claiming. But that information is not available to us anywhere.
Okay, I just assumed when we gave that information that it found its way onto a database somehow or other. Doesn't
no,
do it, huh?
No, sir.
All right, that answers that question. Thank you.
Okay. 2139, false information to enforcing. I tend to say the crowd isn't terribly enthusiastic, are they?
Well, I don't know.
It's hard to get enthusiastic this time of night.
Well, we can come back.
Okay. FA, that's pretty heavy.
The two go hand in hand.
Pretty heavy wrap.
You want to change it to, that's pretty good, change it to B. What is it now, the wildlife piece?
It isn't anything.
We're changing them up to an A. Well, I guess I would have a question.
I can go with 2139, Madam Chair, but I got to think about 2384.
Yeah, I guess the other question is, do we want to change it to a B misdemeanor instead of an A? I don't know. It's up to you. You know, are we...
False name.
I would think B at the most. That would line the two up. No, 2384 is a B and 2039 is an A, the way they're drafted.
Senator Springer?
I'm not interested in 2384 at all, to be honest.
Okay. That's
2139 I can handle.
But as a B, not as an A.
I mean, doesn't matter. It's fine. I don't think we're going to be loading these people up too much anyway.
Madam Chair,
Ingrid,
and members of the committee, the parallel offenses for criminal citations and for traffic citations are A misdemeanors.
Ah, okay, so then I guess you get
parallel.
It's either up or down. It's either up or down or out.
Move 2139 to the floor, due pass.
Okay, Senator Springer moves 2139 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll, please, Kate.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Thank you.
The word out.
I'll be glad to hear that, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
I haven't.
It's your turn tonight, right?
Sure.
I like to create some new crimes. Okay, let's talk about the last bill on the agenda tonight, House Bill 2597. This is the little implied consent law.
Ooh. No one wants to take a crack at 2384.
Well, I'd vote for.
Well, I would too, so if we're still in a work session on that, I'll move House Bill 2384 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Brockman's looking for one to carry.
Yeah.
Well, I think I can handle this.
Fair enough.
All right.
Okay. And it is a B?
The B.
The B.
Okay.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman.
Aye. 2384.
Yeah.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
No.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Carried. Has a bill to carry. Okay, 2597. Dr. Ray Grimsbo is here. Barbara Steffler is here. Lieutenant Rader is here. Who's coming up first? Rader, who's coming? Who's in charge here?
Whose bill is it?
Well... I think it's the police bill.
It is the police bill.
Senator Hill says this is a committee bill.
Okay.
Roger that.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lieutenant Glenn Rader of the Oregon State Police Patrol Division, and our purpose today is to testify in support of House Bill 2597. Passage of this bill would require a person to provide a urine sample to a police officer if the person has been operating a motor vehicle on a public highway or premises open to the public, arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants, and the police officer has reasonable grounds to believe that the person was under the influence of intoxicants. Now, this is exactly the same criteria presently established before a person is required to provide a breath test. Since there is no quantitative value that is attached to drugs like there is to alcohol, the consequences would be for refusing to provide a urine sample. For many years, law enforcement has been faced with the knowledge that an arrested person was under the influence of a controlled substance or a combination of a controlled substance and alcohol. and could not obtain the evidence to show that impairment was caused by drugs. This evidence will be used to prosecute DUI cases, especially where the breath test indicates a low amount of alcohol or no alcohol at all. This evidence will also be used to give health care providers information that allows them to accurately identify and provide a program for drug abuse rather than alcohol abuse through both the diversion program and any time that a person is now convicted of DUI, they must go through an assessment of their problem and a treatment for that problem. Presently, the only thing that they are informed of is the alcohol problem. Since the mid-1980s, we have been acutely aware that the incidences of driving under the influence of drugs have been increasing. This can be directly correlated with the increasing use and illegal sale of drugs in our state. In 1984, our agency began providing instruction to our officers in the detection of drug-impaired drivers. On a national level, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has funded a drug recognition expert program that provides extensive training to a police officer in accurately identifying a drug-impaired driver and the category of the controlled substance that the person has been using. This program is presently in place in 17 states throughout the nation. Since 1984, our agency has been instructing all law enforcement agencies in the state in detection of drug drivers. In 1990, several agencies from the Willamette Valley area began requesting urine samples from all different types of offenders believed to be under the influence of drugs. In May of 1990, our Springfield Crime Laboratory reported that in the last 262 cases where urine samples were obtained, 91% of those samples evaluated tested positive for a controlled substance. And additionally, 27% of those tested positive had two or more drugs in their system. In July of 1990, our crime laboratory did a study of 100 offenders arrested only for DUI. These were offenders that were selected by officers because they thought that they were under the influence of a controlled substance. 82% of those samples evaluated tested positive for drugs, and 26% of those had two or more drugs in their system. In January of this year, our agency, with the funds from the Oregon Traffic Safety Commission and along with the Criminal Justice Crime Analysis Center, began a validated study to obtain a statistically accurate random sample of DUI offenders that are using drugs. The study is presently still going on and will not be completed for about another month, but our preliminary results indicate that, first of all, 50% of the people are not providing urine samples voluntarily, and of those providing a urine sample, 40% of the random samples are under the influence of a controlled substance other than alcohol. This problem facing law enforcement for many years has been the inability to obtain the evidence needed to show drug use. This bill is not a new concept. Majority of the states now permit officers to obtain urine samples under their state's implied consent laws. This bill is supported by virtually every segment of the criminal justice system. I have with me today members of our agency that can answer specific questions regarding the drug recognition expert program, in the scientific evaluation of urine samples, and the constitutionality of this issue. We urge your support in passing this bill as an important tool for law enforcement in identifying offenders that are presently not being prosecuted because of the inability to provide the proper evidence. That concludes my testimony. I'd be pleased to answer any questions the committee may have.
Madam Chair.
Questions? Senator Schumacher.
After you take the urine sample and you send it in for testing and it tests positive, then what happens?
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, the urine sample goes through two processes. First, it's a screening process. And the drug screen tests positive, a confirmation test is then done. the confirmation test is 100% accurate.
Then what happens?
Then this information would be provided to the court at the time of the trial.
And then is there any level that the person has to pass, like an alcohol, if it's 0.08, you are loosely presumed to have been driving while drunk under controlled substances. Let's just assume that there's not no alcohol involved in the hypothetical case, but test positive. Is that enough in itself to sustain a conviction?
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, the scientific community, as you all know, has agreed universally, and particularly in Oregon, you have agreed that 0.08 is under the influence of intoxicants. That's a quantitative value that we can place on this. At the present time, the scientific community universally has not placed a quantitative value on any controlled substance as to what deems to be under the influence. This would be evidence that would be presented at the time of trial that the court would have to make up their own mind as to how much weight to give that evidence, because the officer has observed impairment in driving. And through their training, they have determined that the impairment was caused by a controlled substance, or a controlled substance and alcohol. And the behavior that was manifested in most cases is going to be well beyond the indication of, say, an 04 and 05 that would show on the intoxilizer or the breath test reading. There is no quantitative value, sir, that you can place to say that 35 milligrams of Valium is going to, that all people will be under the influence.
Can you learn from your confirmed sample how proximate to the driving incident the ingestion of the controlled substance might have been? That is how close in time?
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, I'm going to let criminalist Hurley from our crime lab in Springfield answer that question for you.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, my name is Mike Hurley. I'm Assistant Director of the Crime Laboratory in Springfield. You know, we're not able to establish a particular time period on a positive sample. It would be an approximate range. It may be a period of hours, maybe up to 24 hours, and then some drugs could be longer than that. However, it's the weight of the evidence, as Lieutenant Rader indicated, it's additional information. It goes with the officer's observation that we haven't been able to support before. They would indicate the person appeared to be on a drug, yet we had no means to substantiate that. And that's what the purpose it would be, to indicate that, yes, in fact, there was methamphetamine metabolites in this person's body. And that would substantiate a trained officer's observations.
Senator Hill.
As I understand it now, marijuana, which probably, so frequently, doesn't that stay in your system for like a month or something like that? Or
potentially, that's a possibility, but there's also certain levels of abuse, or if you go down to very small levels of detection, you might be able to detect it out to a certain period of time. But through the use of, certain cutoff levels, which they establish in drug rehab programs and a variety of tests, we generally would indicate that the use would have to be recent use, because we're using high cutoff levels, and that it would fall below those if it was not recent use. So that's something that can be worked out.
And, but as I understand now, there is no standard, though, like with alcohol. So when you start saying, you know what I mean, Yeah. I don't know what the level is. It just...
I understand exactly what you mean, and that would be a situation where if someone asked me that in court, I would, you know, answer that question is no, I can't say exactly when that was used. And it would have to be, again, with a trained officer's observation that the situation arises that you get .00s on a breath test, and this person is under the influence of something, and you test their urine, and it comes back cannabis. You know, before we, you know, presently we can't do that.
I'm sure. Are the symptoms always different for the different drugs? I mean, you understand what I'm trying to get. I mean, you'll have to, I would assume that if you found certain things, I'm trying to draw a correlation between what you would observe and what would test out.
Madam Chair and Senator here, I'm going to let Lieutenant Hayes, one of our drug recognition experts, address that question.
Madam Chair, my name is Charles Hayes, and I'm with the Oregon State Police. And as Lieutenant Rader has alluded to, I'm one of the drug recognition experts. There's two of us here with the Oregon State Police. And this training was given in 1989 in Los Angeles, and it's endorsed by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And one of the things that we go through this course for, and it's quite an extensive course, is so that we can determine each category of drug. And there are seven categories of drugs that we're looking for that we test for and evaluate a person for. And the majority of those categories of drugs do have their own separate signs and symptoms that we look for. Now, there are a few that may be similar, but through a series of evaluations and tests, we can easily determine which one of those...
physical tests and not chemical tests at this
That's
time.
Correct, Madam Chair. Yes, that's through... actually, we do physical signs, and we can also do medical evaluations to some degree by checking vital signs, because a lot of vital signs are consistent with certain categories of drugs and certain degrees of impairment.
Madam Chair and Senator Hill, let me give you an example of one of the very simple tests that an officer would give at the scene. You stop someone, and for some reason they determine or believe that the person is under some type of controlled substance. One of the tests that they could give in the field would be a rebound dilation test. Now, this test shows that anyone who has taken cannabis within the last 4 to 6 hours, you take them into a dark room or a completely dark place, you allow their eyes to dilate. You take a pen light and you put right in the pupil of the eye. And while the pen light is being held in the pupil of the eye, the pupil is going to constrict. The person has taken cannabis within the last 4 to 6 hours. While that pen light's still in there, that pupil will open up again within 15 seconds. And that's the only substance that's known to do this. This is one of the special tests that are taught to the officers to give them some indication that that's what that specific category of drug was the one that is causing this impairment. The confirmation test, the urine sample, then confirms the findings of the officer.
Madam Chair, I think the most important thing here is that we have an individual that we have stopped for showing us obvious signs of impairment. Once we get this person out of the car, then we do a set of field sobriety tests the same way that we would do for possibly an alcohol-impaired individual, but then we see that there are not those signs and symptoms that would be associated with alcohol, such as the obvious slurred speech or the possibility of strong odor on the breath and things like that. And so we have an individual who is obviously impaired, and so then we just extend our evaluations and do these other series of tests that are a very obvious tests that are used to determine someone who may be under the influence of some other substance other than alcohol. It's a very systematic approach and scientific, and then we put these people through these tests, and like Lieutenant Rader said, there are certain things we're going to look for. We're going to look for the eyes, we're going to look for pulse rate, we're going to look for blood pressure, all of those things that can show that this person is not in that normal category, and then we'll be able to evaluate this person into one of those drug categories. And then the urine sample that if is obtained, well, then it only assists us in determining what that drug that was causing the impairment may have been.
Madam Chair?
Do
your rules require that your field notes, or whatever you call them, identify the controlled substance that you suspect the person has been using?
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, the field notes only would require us to determine what category the drug may be in, such as a stimulant. As far as actually being precise and saying that it's methamphetamine or it is cocaine or something like that, we do not get that precise because the majority of those stimulants will all give us the same signs and symptoms. We don't actually break it down as to what the particular drug may be.
You do get as specific as you can based upon your observations. I mean, do your rules require that you get as specific as you can?
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, we do not have rules, administrative rules or such that do that, but the procedures that are followed and the training that the officers come out with enables them to list the seven categories of drugs that they're looking for and to say when they complete their evaluation that the person is under the influence of one or a combination of categories of drugs that they're looking at.
And they identify the category?
Yes, sir. They identify them as central nervous system depressants, central nervous system stimulants, cannabis, hallucinogens, narcotic analgesics, and pencyclidine. Those are the seven main broad categories of drugs, and everything from there is then combinations or different derivatives of those different types of drugs.
Somewhat different line of question and concern about rights of privacy and invasion of those rights by basic procedures. And of course, you have to do your urine sample pretty much on site. You can't wait very long, right? How do you do that, particularly with a woman?
I can answer this, Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, because we've been doing some of this through some of our studies that Lieutenant Rader also mentioned in the Eugene area, Albany, and in the Tri-County area here locally. And when that happens, we usually will use a matron if one is available. If there's not a matron available, well, then no urine sample is requested. We just go with the evidence that we have. So we maintain as much privacy as we can. Also, there's other ways of doing this. If you do not have a matron available that could go in with a female suspect, well, you can actually give the person complete privacy by allowing them to use a restroom with taking certain sanctions, and that would be coloring of the water so that there's blue water in the toilet bowl. There's maybe no sink available. You can also check the actual sample itself, because we know that the sample, a fresh sample, is going to be obviously warm to touch, or the container will be warm. So there are certain sanctions that you can use that you will not invade the privacy of the individual being tested.
Senator Hill. Yes, Senator Rader, you have that a majority of the states now permit officers to obtain urine samples under their implied consent laws. Does that mean that it's a violation if they refuse to take the urine test, just like you're proposing here?
Madam Chair and Senator Hill, that's correct. There are presently 39 states that permit this for drugs.
Thank you.
Where did the 17 states come from?
Madam Chair, those 17 states presently have this drug recognition expert program funded by National Highway Traffic
okay,
Safety Administration
you.
In place.
Okay. Senator Springer?
Let me understand how this is kind of working out here in the field with your tests. Are you finding that the officer makes the decision to perhaps administer the breath test in every situation, and if the breath test shows unduly low, yet the officer has some reason to suspect there's another intoxicant, they then will go to the urine sample, or they'll take the person in, do a urine, then a breath, or do them at the same time, or what's the protocol here?
Madam Chair and Senator Springer, it is our intention that what is going to happen is the person generally will be brought in, given a breath test. And as you say, if it's a very low amount of alcohol, the behavior is manifested, that they have some other reasonable cause, that the person indicates a controlled substance, then they would ask for a urine sample. There are going to be cases where you bring the person into jail and the first thing that they have to do is use the restroom. And they have manifested some behavior. And, of course, you want to attempt to obtain the first void that contains the metabolites. And then you could ask for the urine sample prior to the breath test. And that's the manner in which this bill was written. But generally, it's going to be the breath test first. And then if there is some indication of a controlled substance used, then they would ask for the urine sample.
Okay, another quick question, if I may. It looks like some of your preliminary work, you found a pretty high correlation between people who are being arrested or for DUII and those who have positive tests for drugs or intoxicants. From this preliminary work, can you just anticipate roughly how many folks who are stopped for DUII you expect are also going to be given a urine sample?
Madam Chair,
half the cases, three quarters, two thirds, or?
Madam Chair and Senator Springer, those first two tests that I talked about where we had the 91%, 82%, those were people who were selected by police officers out of everyone that was arrested. The random sample that we have indicates that 40 out of 145 samples that we take, 40% of the sample, all the samples we did on a random basis were people provided. So that is the best information that we have at the time. It's at least 40% and perhaps a little bit more.
How do you think this is actually, yeah, maybe I'm asking to predict something which you can't predict. I mean, if we adopt this, I don't know how many DUI arrests you're making a year of the state police. It's probably thousands. Can you estimate if in half of those arrests you expect people are going to be asked to do a urine? Or?
Madam Chair and Senator Springer, I think you had the right question. It's one that we cannot predict because we haven't been doing it. The random sample is the best thing we have. It was 40% of what we did. That would be the best number that I would have to go with.
There may have been other variables there that, and the size of the sample. I don't know if it's possible for anyone to predict what would happen.
That's very possible, sir.
But it could be approaching 50%, I guess, from what you're saying.
Madam Chair and Senator Springer, all of the samples that are taken by